Hello and welcome to the Let's Talk Bipolar podcast, hosted by Emma Bell and brought to you by Bipolar UK. You can find all of our resources at www.bipolaruk.org. Hi Ian, and welcome to Let's Talk Bipolar podcast. How are you today?
Doing good, Emma. Thank you very much for the invite to come and speak to you.
I'm really excited to have you on. As you know, this podcast is to talk to people that live with bipolar and also to talk to professionals in the world of research and medical care for those that live with bipolar. And you are a professional in this field. So can you start by telling us a little bit about you and how you feature professionally in the world of bipolar and what you're really interested in?
Excellent. So I'm a psychiatrist by training. So I trained in medicine, as psychiatrists do. Sometimes that's not clear, but I did general medical training, worked for a little bit in general medicine, then moved over, which was always the plan, to train in psychiatry. And when I started psychiatry, I was really interested in research. Mm-hmm. So very soon kind of transferred over to a kind of research training path and got involved with doing research on bipolar disorder. So, and I've stayed as an academic. So I'm a professor of psychiatry at Cardiff University, and I'm director of the National Centre for Mental Health. And with colleagues at Worcester University, I lead Professor Lisa Janser, I lead the Bipolar Disorder Research Network. So my involvement is as a clinician, and I can tell you a little bit more about the clinical things I do, but you know, the main day job is as a researcher and as a director of a research institute.
Mm. So we're in good hands. I'm in good hands with you right now. I hope so.
I'm not quite so confident, but yeah, I'll take that.
Yeah. No, for sure. For sure I am. And I was also looking at a bit of what you specialise your research in. And this is of particular interest to me as a female, as a uterus owner living with bipolar. You have a keen interest and a vast professional background in women and postpartum psychosis and prenatal kind of treatment for severe mood disorder conditions, right?
Yeah, that particular interest. I'm a psychiatrist, but I'm what they call a perinatal psychiatrist. So mm-hmm. I'm really interested in mental health issues in pregnancy and mm-hmm. the postpartum period. And the reason I really became interested in that, it's interesting actually, because I became interested in bipolar disorder first, you mm-hmm. know, and with kind of my clinical and my research mentor. Nick Craddock, who's retired now, but still involved with the work. I worked on a project that he had going around the country, going around the UK, interviewing people with bipolar disorder. It was a fantastic job because, you know, being paid to go around and listen to people tell their stories is outstanding way to earn your living. And what really struck me actually was the women I was talking to with lived experience of bipolar disorder. So commonly, episodes in relation to having a baby were prominent, either the first significant episode a woman had had or a really important episode. And so I became interested in what's called postpartum psychosis, or mm-hmm. it used to be called puerperal psychosis, but nobody could say it and certainly nobody could spell it. So we've kind of become a little bit more American and we use the term postpartum psychosis now. So interested in this condition because I thought it was such a fascinating clue to help us understand what causes bipolar disorder, because there is there's something about childbirth that is a really powerful trigger for many women and can trigger off these really significant severe episodes of bipolar illness. Yeah, so women were telling me this. I thought, you know, found their stories absolutely fascinating. And I thought, actually, that's what I'd really like to specialize in as far as my research is concerned and my clinical work. So that's how I ended up being interested in that area.
What an incredible section of your career to be able to go around and just talk to the people that are living with bipolar and then to, you know, be, as you say, picking up on these clues that pregnancy and childbirth is a huge trigger for what can be the first onset, I suppose, of bipolar. Is that what you found?
Yeah, and I think that's a kind of a principle for our research program, if you like, is that we know that this is a really important illness that can really severely affect individuals. We know, actually, saying that, and we can come on to that later, and the other aspect of the work I've been involved with in bipolar is the psychoeducation program work I've been done. So I think helping people live the best life they can with bipolar has been a really important part of my work as well. But we know this is a really severe illness. And if we can find out more about what is it that causes people to become unwell, the goal then will be to help us develop ways of prevention, preventing people becoming ill or treating people, and again coming up with better treatments that we have at the moment, because anybody that lives with bipolar knows is that treatments can be effective, can help, but some of the treatments that we have, medications, kind of have side effects, and what we need is better ways of treating people. So a principle of our work really has been, everybody's experience of this illness is different, but if we can do really detailed work, and the assessments that we do can really capture that breadth of experience that people have out there, that there'll be patterns that we can pick up and things that we can notice. And the relationship illness to childbirth, to having a baby, is one of those things that really stood out to us. Mm. And we've done a lot more work to try and understand that better. It is a really important aspect of many women that live with this condition, and really impacts on them in a huge ways, because it impacts on their decisions to start a family, to extend their family. All of these is really, and that comes back, so it's not just a research interest, it's a clinical interest. And the clinic, I do in Cardiff, second opinion clinic, that I see people from all over the UK for women with bipolar disorder who are struggling with some of these questions, before thinking about having a baby, and we work out together how to the best kind of plan for them. So it's a really interesting area, and it's been what's underpinned the work I've done, both my clinical work and my research work throughout the career.
Incredibly fascinating. And I'm very open, and I share on social media everything really about bipolar and also about my fertility journey, because I have a diagnosis of diminished ovarian reserve. So the likelihood of me being pregnant without IVF is super slim. So I get a lot of women who are living with bipolar reaching out to me saying, I'm frightened to start a family, I've got bipolar, or what do I do about my medication, I'm scared to take it. So I love that you're in this area, because it is an area of great concern for any human that is a uterus owner, right? And it is I suppose one of the differentials between a uterus owner and not a uterus owner in the journey of living with bipolar, because if you're going to carry a baby, then this arises for you, and it can feel overwhelming. And I've definitely asked myself the questions, will I be okay? Will I be able to manage it? Will I become unwell? At which point will the medication affect my baby? And all of these things. So you'll suddenly feel like not only are you entering into pregnancy and potential motherhood, you're also entering some kind of mad assault course at the same time with your mental health. And it can feel very overwhelming.
I think it's one of the most difficult decisions that women have to make with this condition is, I think one of the positive things to say, though, is that although there is a risk of becoming severely unwell and developing a condition like postpartum psychosis, and that risk needs to be taken seriously, and you need to enter your pregnancy recognizing that and doing everything you can to deal with that risk. The vast majority of women I see in my clinic who are considering making that decision do go on to decide to have a baby, and do go on make fantastic parents, and do go on to, even if they become unwell, you know, they don't regret it. So I think 30 years ago, 40 years ago, perhaps professionals like me would be telling bipolar women with bipolar disorder to not start a family, not to have babies. I don't think that's what's happening now.
No.
I think there's been a real development of clinical services with specialist perinatal mental health services across the UK, which is absolutely fantastic. And money has gone into that in all parts of the UK in order to really work with women and help them, through this period of risk. And I think that's been really positive, but I wouldn't want women to go away with the feeling that this was a no-no or completely negative. It's about knowing the risk, knowing what you're dealing with, working out how best, the best decision for you as far as continuing your medication, switching your medication, stopping your medication, thinking about all those other factors that we know, because medication is only one part of the things that can help us remain well. And Emma, I think you're probably better placed than me to.
I'm a big advocate for that. Yeah. A big believer, and I know I'm kind of living it. I know that. It's been a bitter pill to swallow, if I'm honest. It's taken me, I got diagnosed 10 years ago, and it's taken me an awful long time to really accept and get real with the fact that I live with bipolar and that I can't just go to therapy, get fixed, and my life's going to be okay again. And I'm going to go back to normal again. Not that I believe normal exists anyway, but you know what I mean? And that I can beat it and squash it and I'm going to win. It's this sort of humbleness of I have to accept gracefully that I am going to coexist and befriend bipolar and live with and learn to dance with and coexist with, cohabit.
I love that phrase, learn to dance with. I think that's a beautiful way of expressing it, but I agree entirely that that's what it's about. This isn't something that can be cured, taken away. You have to find a way that for you, you can live the best life that you can live with this. And we know from fantastic examples like yourself and others that although this can be really significant, severe, difficult illness to live with, that people can live a good life. And I think people like yourself helping people to do that is excellent. And another thing that picking up from what you said is I talked about the psychoeducation programs that we've been developed and offered to probably about 850 people now with lived experience of bipolar disorder in our group in Cardiff. What's really come out of that is that journey that people need to go on to accept. And often it's kind of, you can see in people that come through the groups, it's only 3 or 4 weeks in perhaps, sometimes it's the first time that they've ever really admitted to themselves, even though they've had this label, this diagnosis, even though they've taken treatment. And listening to other people with the condition, which is why, the work that Bipolar UK does is so important, is listening to each other, learning from their experiences, accepting that that's the situation that they're in, and then going on to work out how to live the best life. It's been such a joy to be part of that with people.
And it really is, this acceptance thing, I think, is massive. And I find it really interesting. Obviously, I can only speak from my experience and those that I've spoken to, which is nowhere near the number of people you've been exposed to in your career. But it's just interesting to hear you kind of reflect that back to me, that it is fairly true for most people's journey, that this journey of accepting, it comes in layers. So I accepted the label, then I accepted some changes I had to make. And then I kind of had to go, then I got fatigued because I only made some changes, but still fighting the others, then accept the next layer and then the next layer. And then it's sort of like a surrender in the end to, okay, so I can put my boxing gloves on all day long. And don't get me wrong, putting my boxing gloves on at the beginning kept me alive because I needed that fight to stay alive while I was learning how to dance with this beast. But rather than controlling it, it was just, as you say, like learning to dance with it. And eventually you're like, okay, so we better just make friends, you and I, because we're in it for the long haul together and we need to figure out how to respect each other and live together.
I think that journey is a really good way of putting it. And I think if I can reflect on health professionals' role in that journey, I think that we've known for quite some time that getting the right label, actually getting the right diagnosis is that people with bipolar disorder, that's often a massive issue, that clinicians sometimes are making other labels, giving other labels, and not really recognizing the bipolar nature of the illness. So I think that's something that we need to get better. I think work that Bipolar UK has done has shown this can be 8 years, 10 years, 12 years, people, you know, get that right label. And then I think as clinicians, we need to be better at working with people on the, you know, once we've made that label, that's not the end of our responsibility then. We need to work with people in that way so that they go through those various stages of accepting, realizing what that means, to get them to the stage where they, can I use that lovely phrase again, dancing with this illness, and, you know, in a way that makes them, enables them to live their best life. So I think it's, there are issues for people with lived experience then to go down that journey. But we as clinicians, I think, have to look at our responsibility and how we can better do that. You know, one of the ways that we've helped with that in the work that we've done in the group in Cardiff is taking this psychoeducation approach. So psychoeducation isn't a name I like.
Tell me more about that.
So it's about understanding. And I think for many conditions, health conditions, understanding all you can about the illness, what it is, what are the options as far as helping treatment options, are really important. And this isn't something that just mental health services do. This is a really key part of helping people say come to live the best life they can with diabetes, for example. And there are really good programs that are set up that work with people to understand what the important factors are and what they can do. So in some respects, mental health, we're a bit behind other areas of medicine in this. So the psychoeducation program we do, it's 10 session group. And the important part is the group bit, because it brings people together with lived experience to learn from each other.
Group is so powerful.
It covers things like, what bipolar is, what do these labels that are thrown around, what do they mean? What does bipolar 1 mean? What does bipolar 2 mean? What does rapid cycling mean? When you hear, what does cyclothymia mean? All of these terms that are used, what does psychosis mean? What is a delusion? All of these things. What causes bipolar disorder? As far as we know, and we really need more, understanding of that. The multifactorial causation that this really is a biological, a social, a psychological, spiritual, a political. All of these things are really important. I think. What are the treatments? Understanding the medications that are used and why they're being used. Because I think unless you understand what you're being given, there's no chance that you'll stick with it. What about other methods? Self-management. What about monitoring your mood? How can that help? How can self-management? What is the impact of your lifestyle? For something that where we know that drug and alcohol misuse can be a real problem for people with bipolar disorder and can make things worse. What about sleep patterns? What about, and psychological treatment management? All of these are covered, So that's what we mean. And I think it's been fantastic to work with groups of people who learn from each other, actually. And that's the other thing that really is key. I know from my past, too long, of being a clinician, getting older.
Too long.
but actually I can talk until I'm blue in the face and people will go, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. But actually if you hear from somebody else who's been in your shoes, who's been there, who said, I thought I was the exception and I could, stay out all night drinking and taking drugs, and actually it wasn't, but actually I've learned that actually this is not great for you can learn from somebody who's been there, then it's much more useful. So it's been a pleasure doing that. Since lockdown, it's been more difficult to bring groups together. So we've been piloting it now recently, some online groups over things like Zoom, which have worked really well. So that's the other kind of development that we're kind of working at the moment, because actually that might be a better solution in the long run anyway, if we can get it to work, because getting people together, you can get people from a distance. So that's all.
And more accessible. Like, the other thing that I'd say to that is that when you are living with bipolar and you sometimes getting yourself somewhere in a social setting can be a huge challenge. So, you know, in a way, you know, COVID obviously has been horrendous for so many people in so many ways, but also it has made things more accessible for someone who was struggling to get themselves up and dressed and out that day. Maybe they can scrape themselves together for a Zoom call, you know? I'd like to just go back to a couple of things that you said.
Okay.
For our audience. So would you elaborate on some clarification of some of the terms in this conversation? So the hypomania, the rapid cycling, psychosis, mania, could you just talk us through the key words that are thrown about and kind of debunk a few things and clarify a few things?
Okay, so this is the way I think about it, okay? And this might help, this might not, and people might want to, you know, you can ask me some questions if I'm not making any sense.
Mm-hmm.
So bipolar disorder is a mood disorder, a condition that affects people's emotions, their affect, their mood, yeah? Mm-hmm. Now, everybody on the planet has high mood and low mood. Everybody knows what it's like to feel sad. Yeah, everybody knows what it's like to feel elated, happy. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. For people with bipolar disorder, though, those experiences of those swings of mood are much more extreme and get to the point where we would talk as clinicians about that being a clinical episode of a mood episode. So mm-hmm. For depression, that's not just feeling sad, that's having a constellation of lots of other symptoms that occur together, not, you know, you're losing your appetite, you know, having difficulty sleeping, waking up in the morning, losing all your energy. I could go on and on and mm-hmm. on and list those symptoms that, you know, your listeners will be very familiar with. When they all cluster together and go on for a certain period of time, you know, arbitrarily we pick, you know, two weeks out of the, you know, the ethers. If they go on for, you know, it's not just, you know, a few hours of feeling like that, but that goes on for a significant period of time. And perhaps most importantly, that those symptoms have caused significant impairment in your functioning. So they affect your emotion, your social functioning, your occupational functioning. So symptoms clustering together, going on for that long period of time, we talk about an episode, and then you give that label of a depressive, major depression episode.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are vulnerable to those depression episodes, yeah. Mm-hmm. But they don't have the high mood. That kind of illness we call unipolar depression, major depressive disorder. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For some people, yeah, like yourself, like others listening to this podcast, I'm sure they've experienced episodes of high mood as well. Now that's where it all gets a little bit more complicated. Again, it's not just feeling happy, right?
No.
And I think that's what the kind of stigma sometimes is about bipolar, in that people think it's just having mood swings, people are a bit happy and a bit sad. Yeah. Yeah. But for it to be a clinical condition, you want to see clustering of symptoms, and high mood symptoms might include having increased energy, talking rapidly, having lots of thoughts rushing through your head, not sleeping at night, feeling grandiose, feeling that you've got the solutions for everything. Yeah, and I'm sure your listeners will kind of be ticking off the ones like them.
I am too.
Clustering together, yes, yeah, so going on for a period of time. Now, with the classification system, say 2 weeks for depression, it's a week for mania, or even a bit shorter for hypomania. I'll say something about mania or hypomania in a minute. And again, potentially causing impairment. Mm-hmm. Now, where the difficulty comes in the high moods is that we've just got depression. With high moods, we've got degrees of high mood,
mm-hmm.
what I call sometimes hypomania, and full-blown mania. Now, full-blown mania is where it causes significant impairment. You know, people with mania may have psychotic symptoms, may be admitted to hospital, may need treatment, you know, may cause themselves real difficulties in high episodes. It's not just a wonderful place to be. You know, I remember the first person I saw as a doctor with bipolar disorder lived up in the valleys in South Wales, and he'd managed in a grandiose state to convince somebody to send him a £250,000 boat to his council flat. Yeah, that he bought. You know, so it's an example of the difficulties that being high can cause for your life, and he had to disentangle that. But for some people, the high mood episodes they have don't meet that really severe level causing impairment, but they can have high episodes, but really at the level that it doesn't really cause impairment, doesn't really need treatment. And those are called hypomanic episodes. Mm-hmm. And the difference is if you have the full-blown mania, the full-blown manic episodes, you get the label bipolar one that you mm-hmm. may have come across.
Yeah.
Those people with low moods, and the low moods can be very severe and very, and even psychotic, but the high moods are not that as severe, the hypomanic type episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, people can be given the label of bipolar two.
Mm-hmm.
So that's major depression, that's bipolar one, bipolar two. I could mm-hmm. go on, talk about others, but is there any other particular things?
Well, so I know that we've sort of touched on this before with the whole diagnosis. So myself as an example, I have the diagnosis of bipolar one because I have had mania twice. But I would say for 80 to 90% of my life, I would live as a bipolar two person. Now, it's interesting, isn't it? Because if I was to just, because labels are helpful, but here's this kind of other side that I see to it, that if I was to tell someone, oh, I've got bipolar one, then they may very quickly, with a very small amount of information, which, let's face it, unless you're in the world of bipolar yourself as a professional or someone living with it, you probably only hear just the, you know, the Homeland's version or whatever it is, right? So the TV version of bipolar, whatever it is for you. So as someone who says, oh yeah, I have a diagnosis of bipolar one, someone may think that I spend a majority of my time battling with full-blown mania. So I find it interesting that I sort of feel it would almost be helpful to have like a percentage diagnosis. I don't know. You know, Emma is 10% bipolar one, 90% bipolar two. I don't know. I just feel like maybe that might be more helpful.
I think you put your finger on a really important point there, Emma, which is labels can be helpful. And I think actually in bipolar disorder, they're kind of more helpful than in some other areas of mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think getting the right diagnosis, knowing what you're dealing with, recognizing that this is a bipolar form of mood disorder, can be really helpful to get the treatment that's best, for you to live that life that you live the best life that you can, which is the goal that we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I think getting that label is helpful. Bipolar disorder, I think, you know, I'm a big believer that diagnosis can really help people.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that we mustn't do is think that it explains everything.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that we really must do better in services, I think, is recognize that these are always hypotheses. These are always, the latest label, and can always need to be returned to, looked at, seeing if it still applies, and the progression that many people have, for example, in their diagnosis with bipolar, is that may have had a diagnosis of anxiety, may have had a diagnosis of depression, then maybe bipolar two, and then maybe have a full blown manic episode and go to bipolar one. So we know that the diagnosis will change. That's really important. Always must be. Nobody should be making assumptions about you and the mm-hmm. detail of your experience basing on that just short mm-hmm. label. Isn't what defines you. Just like our mental illness doesn't define us as people, we are more than that. And actually so that's really important, that we return, we look, we review, and as clinicians that we always say, what's the evidence that that's still the best label that's helping us treat this person. And then the other thing to remember is the experience covered by somebody with bipolar 1 diagnosis, for example, might be one episode of mania, completely in their life, or somebody that struggles with 5 or 6 episodes of severe mania and depression a year. So it's only part of the story.
And
I think it's something that we should be open to as researchers and as clinicians and as people with lived experiences, is working together to work out the best way forward through this. Are there better ways? So people have talked about using dimensions and talking about, we've kind of ourselves in our research tried to come up with these ways of putting, as you say, actually, score out of 100 on how manic, score out of 100 on how much depression there is,
yes.
Score out of 100 in how much psychosis there is. That trouble is that these things become very unwieldy to be used in the clinical form, but it's not that we shouldn't try. So I think I've waffled on a lot there, but I think the point that you make is that this doesn't define you with that label, but despite labels being helpful, they are always must be considered temporary, and be looked at again, to see what the evidence is, and they don't describe the whole person by any stretch of the imagination.
No, and I love that, because I think just because I have bipolar, someone else has bipolar. Just because I have a diagnosis of bipolar 1 because I've been manic twice in my life, and someone else, our lives can still look very different. And it's sort of important to keep that individualism of the person. And I love that it's kind of being looked into as this score out of 100. And because that's the way I kind of try to look at it. It's like, if I look at my life, what percentage of my life is affected by which state of my mood disorder? And that gives me a better idea of how to live with what I'm living with.
For many people with bipolar disorder, the high mood isn't the problem, actually. The thing that really causes them most difficulties, is the low mood, But it's important to label the high mood, because that can really impact on how clinicians will look to treat the low mood, because there's the evidence that for people with a bipolar form of the illness, maybe antidepressants don't work as well as in people who haven't got bipolar disorder, that there's a risk of antidepressants triggering off high episodes. And so
which is what happened for me.
Important. Yeah, really important.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be recognized its limitations as well.
And you're completely right. I mean, I was misdiagnosed with depression because I was presenting to the doctor low.
Mm.
When I was in hypermania, I didn't present to the doctor because I was socially accepted as acing life, right? but actually...
We all want a little bit of hypermania.
Yeah. and the truth is, when you actually get put on medication and you lose that part of you, it brings on... a period of, for me anyway, like frustration, resentment, a feeling of entitlement, like I should be able to have this, so therefore I won't take that because I want to feel like that. And so this entitlement seems to come through, because guess what, that's how you've lived your life the whole of your life. So to feel different is difficult because it's not familiar to you. You are used to riding that wave, right? So when you don't ride it anymore, you miss it.
Used to those highs, sometimes just in the middle can be normal, whatever that means, that can feel
you're right. And I was talking to somebody the other day that I mentor, and she was saying to me that the more stable she gets, this is the most difficult part for her as she stabilizes, because it's like she's searching, looking for something to fill the gaps of the wave. And I could relate to what she was saying, because you kind of get to a point when you do have those moments, and I'm certainly not stable all of the time, but when I have, when I'm graced with these moments of, stableness, you kind of sit and think, well, is this it, because you are used to that kind of like adrenaline, cortisol fueled state of mood. So I think physically your body, your nervous system gets used to being in that space. So when you're then not in that space, it can sort of feel a little, I don't know, difficult, awkward, unfamiliar, which obviously makes us feel unsafe. So then we go into trying to grab things, cope things, do things, you know, until we kind of work through those things. Because for me, I'd spent the best part of 30 years never knowing what that description, you know, no feelings of mania, no feelings of depression, outlook on life is good. I genuinely had not experienced that feeling until I got to 30 years old. I can never, ever remember feeling like that. So it makes sense to me that if you've gone a long period in life of never having that feeling, even on a day, to then have that feeling, it's completely alien and it's completely new territory. And it takes time to trust that actually it's safe to feel that way.
And I think as clinicians, recognizing that, you know, we used the word journey before and it is a journey, isn't it? Mm. Recognizing that it will take time for you to get to that point where you realize I'm missing those highs, those hypomanias, that buzz. Mm. But actually that buzz as well sometimes goes beyond to those that times where that the mania is causing me real problems, you know, and I'm spending money I haven't got. I'm ending up in hospital. I'm getting into fights with my, you know, my loved ones and, you know, friendship. That's the cost of that buzz. The other cost is the lows. Yeah. The other side of the coins. And sometimes, yeah, it is a journey that people have to go on to realize that maybe to deal with those lows and to deal with those really significant highs, you need to lose that buzz.
And it's a big adjustment, you know, it is a big adjustment, even though it is better and healthier and, a more stable way to be. It's an adjustment. And if your body just simply hasn't experienced that before, and then, it's a bit like if I came along to someone that didn't have bipolar and suddenly gave them, I don't know, a week or two of being hypermanic and then, you know, a few months of being depressed, I'm pretty sure they would struggle to cope with those feelings and think, where on earth has this all come from? You know, and it can be the same in the reverse when you stabilize, where it's just alien, right? And it is an adjustment. But you're right, because as the hypermania kind of revs up, you get all the good stuff. But then it does tip over. So it tips over into agitation, picking fight. You know, I used to I could pick a fight with a paper bag if I wanted to go back, you know, no one could say a word and I'd be picking that, you know, and it was my way or the highway. Everyone else is too slow. Why is everyone so stupid? No one can keep up with me. They're all just really stupid. Like, because I'm already onto the 10th idea and they're on idea number two. Why can't they keep up? And it's a genuine like,
and that can be difficult for other people to live with, can't it? That's not easy. That's not an easy task for your loved ones to cope with that, you know.
No, not at all. But of course, you don't see it that way, right, at the time.
No,
it's an utter belief that this is how life is, right? It's not like, it's not even like this, my way's, well, it is a bit my way's the right way and everyone else is the high, you know, sees the highway. But it is a genuine belief of, this is how it is because it's your reality and you just can't get your head around why everyone else can't see it the way you see it. So it's just an interesting, I find the whole thing fascinating. Obviously it's been life breaking, heartbreaking for me during my journey of, especially when I've been very unwell and for those around me to witness, be around and all of that. But so I've got a few questions here that people have sent. What new research is on the horizon, specifically regarding treatment, including medication?
It's a really great question, and I'm probably not the ideal person to answer that, as it, you know, as developing new pharmacological approaches, medications isn't kind of my particular area of expertise. But what I would say is in order to make massive steps forward in in developing better treatments, treatments that work better, treatments with less side effects, treatment medications that don't have some of the problems of the ones that we have at the moment, which many do fantastic things to help people with bipolar disorder, but that can sometimes be at the cost of some side effects as well. I think we need to understand this illness better. You know, we really need to understand what are the causes. So part of the work that we're doing at the Bipolar Disorder Research Network, which has had the help of over 7,000 people with bipolar disorder around the UK, and please let me know if you've not helped with our research and would like to be part of the research effort and be part of that collaboration, you know, because it is a collaboration between researchers and people with lived experience, you know, that would be fantastic. What we're trying to do in looking at genetic factors, looking at biological factors, looking at psychological factors, is really trying to advance our understanding. Yeah. Mm. And I think it's a slow process, and I can't promise, you know, major leap forwards, anytime soon. But I do think that this is an illness that we can understand better. And if we do that, then that will lead naturally. We've got a fantastic drug development team in Cardiff that I work very closely with. You know, there are some really clever people who can translate that better understanding then into better treatments. So probably not the best person to answer that question other than to say hang in there. And I think this is really difficult for people who are living with this condition. Is the patience that you need to for me to say things like this might take 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, but I genuinely believe that the work that's being done now will lead to better treatments. Mm-hmm. And actually, the other thing I really believe is all the work that's been done now, research that's been done now, will ultimately be judged by how it improves the life of people with this condition. So that's how we're going to be judged. But please stick with us.
Sure. And what I'll do is I'll get Ian to send over some links if anyone wants to be involved in the research, and we'll pop it in the show notes. So maybe you could tell me the best way for people to get in touch. I'd like to do that too. What's the number one thing we can do to stay well?
What a brilliant question. But I suspect
wouldn't we love the answer to that?
I think, how about I say this? It's going through that journey and getting to that place where you accept that, you know, that this is something that you're living with. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And finding the way for you to live better. I feel that for many people, if not most people, if not the majority of people with bipolar disorder, that medication can be helpful and can play a role. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think some people with bipolar disorder, they can live without medication, but I think medication can be important. Yeah.
Absolutely.
But those other kind of self-management, you know, mood monitoring, you know, looking at your lifestyle, all of those factors are important. So I don't think there's one thing, because it's going to depend on the individual, but come into that state, place where you've looked at those factors and found for you what are the important aspects. Yeah, that's probably the most important place that you can be.
You know, when you do your groups, what would you say are the top three things that come out of those groups that people come back with sort of over and over, you know, the most talked about things that people do and share with each other? You say you kind of witness them sharing things with each other. What would you say their top three are?
That's a really good, really, really good question. I don't think we've ever been asked that. I'd like to go back to John and the other members of the team that kind of are involved in the sessions and really look at that. I think for some people, coming to that place of finding the combination of medication or medications that works best for them and accepting that, you know, not beating themselves up. I think I'm a big believer that there is kind of pill shaming in mental health that there isn't in other forms of health.
Absolutely.
I think medication isn't the solution, isn't the only answer. It's not, you know, but it's not what it's sometimes portrayed as being as a, you know, that if you're taking medication, you're given in or you know,
no.
you're, and actually can help people get to that stage of stability that they can sort out those other things that are important in their life. So
absolutely.
Sleep is a massive thing that comes out that mm-hmm. people who are kind of painting, burning the candle at both ends, is that the right expression?
Yeah.
Pushing themselves, think that's one of the things that often comes out, that finding that way of getting enough sleep is really, really important with bipolar disorder. I think this is a difficult one, actually, and kind of it is, and some people find this the most difficult thing to come to terms with, but actually for people with bipolar disorders, drugs and alcohol can be really problematic. So recognizing for you what your limits are in our groups we don't advocate people don't drink at all, but certainly
it helps. I haven't had a drink for 2 years. And it's massively helpful. But what I have learned is that I was never a massive drinker. Drugs would have featured more in my life in my younger years than alcohol. But what I have learned is that it was a way to cope and escape how I felt. So it wasn't until I got to grips with my feelings, my emotions, why I was having them, what was triggering me, that I could move away from my coping mechanism and build other tools in my toolkit to help me feel my emotions without trying to numb them. And that's just been a huge one for me. And it's made me realize that I was never really modeled healthy emotional processing, healthy conflict resolution. So I was never really modeled those things. So then when you're then dealing with bipolar and you are, as you say, completely heightened or plummeted to the very top and bottoms of the mood scale, and you don't have these skills to say it's okay to have big feelings and I've got these tools to help me process them, then when you're absolutely flying high, then you just turn to things that make these things easier to deal with, or so it seems at the time. And I do believe that's a big part of it, because medication is a huge tool. When I first got diagnosed, it was the only tool in my toolkit for bipolar. Right, it was the only one, that and seeing my psychiatrist. I had no other way to cope, to see a way out, to get better. But I was also so poorly that I needed that to stabilize me. It saved my life. It turned me into a bit of a zombie for a while, 3 years. And it had lots of these sort of negative side effects that you sort of spoke of. And it saved my life. It was absolutely vital. And what it did is it was like putting stabilizers on a bike. It stabilized me enough to then have the capacity to do therapy, to go to see someone, to talk through these things. If you tried to put me into therapy when I was so dysregulated, so unstable, so unwell, I wouldn't have had the capacity to process everything that therapy would have brought up for me. Because guess what? When you go into therapy, it brings up stuff from before, and that triggers your mental health illness. So I'm utterly grateful that this exists, that medication exists, because it definitely saved my life and enabled me to have some capacity to then go on and do the work. Because I started off thinking that I'd go into therapy and, the wave of a little magic wand and I'd be fixed. And off I'd trot. But it doesn't work like that. You go into therapy and you start work. It is hard work, and you do have to turn over some painful things, some things that are unresolved, and that in itself can be very triggering to your mental health condition, that can then trigger off another high or low episode. So medication really helps to kind of stabilize that and take the real high and the real low edge off of that, so you can then be more stable to be open to therapy, I believe. And then the more you work through that stuff, that's in line with the therapy that I did. The more therapy I did, the less medication help I needed. And it's kind of done that for me. Do you know what I mean? In the opposite way. And it's been a really interesting experience for me.
I suppose what that doesn't mean as well is that if you don't, you know, let's hope that that doesn't happen, but if you became severely unwell again, it might be medication that you need at that stage to get you back to, you know. So, but I think what I'd say from what you're saying is that's a beautifully balanced way of thinking about these things. You know, I'm really suspicious of anybody in this area that thinks, you know, medication is all bad or all good, or it's all about therapy or it's all not about therapy, it's all about your diet or it's all not, you know. Yeah, these are difficult, complex, multifactorial, you know, this is a condition that, you know, and the ways in which to help people are that as well. And I really don't want to see any kind of these approaches, you know, excluded.
So I see it now as, now I've learned other tools in my toolkit. So at the beginning I had two tools. I had my psychiatrist and I had medication. I didn't know any other way. And slowly but surely I built other tools into the toolkit. Medication is still one of those tools. And if I suddenly find myself feeling unwell, like I did last year, I went through a period of, you know, feeling suicidal last year. I've got my crisis plan written. My husband knows what it is. And the plan is psychiatrist, medication. And now 10 years in, I know exactly what medication's going to help me because I've tried and tested a few as well. And don't get me wrong, I had to go through a few that were, you know, it's just the way it is, because what works for me won't work for someone else. What works for them won't work for me. It's so individual. But I've kind of found my little recipe now. So now I know that's what I need to do. And I go in and the psychiatrist says to me, he says, you know what you need to take. And I'm like, I know. So gives me the prescription and off we go. Right. And there's not that resistance to it now, but it takes a bit of trial and error as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And hopefully as we understand more about the illness and develop better treatments, the other thing that we'll be able to do is be able to understand better what treatments will work for what people, because you're right, it's really trial and error at the moment. Mm-hmm. Just try a bit of this, see if this works, see if that helps, try, you mm-hmm. know, add this, take up, you know. Yeah, it would be great to say, you know, based on what we know about Emma, or you know, kind of what, you know, kind of read out from your blood scores or something, if we can develop that. This is all very much in the future, but this is what I'm hoping for. Yeah.
God, I mean, that would just be incredible. but it would require a much broader approach to the individual to be able to do that, wouldn't it? And it would need to take in all factors of, you know, full family history. And I don't just mean on a mental illness, I mean on experiential events that have happened that may have brought trauma to the table. You know, what the sort of environment you've been brought in and modeled in, all of these things would play into being able to be that kind of precise and say, well, based on all of these factors, this is kind of what we think would help you. And I'd love to see it get to that point where it is a more kind of 360 approach to it, I suppose. Like, for example, when I got assessed, yeah, you get asked about drink, you get asked about drugs, but no one asked me about previous trauma. No one asked me about my sex life and how that plays out or doesn't, or, you know, and actually these things are huge contributing factors when you live with bipolar. And I just found it now, 10 years on, I find it really interesting that those questions weren't asked 10 years ago, but obviously we've made huge advances now. But these are really vital questions, especially when you're tying in alcohol and substance use. Quite often they will go hand in hand with sexual activity. So if you don't, you know, you kind of need all of these components.
I think that's all about treating people, looking at the whole person, isn't it? Yeah,
for sure.
Being what, you know, what the buzz phrase at the moment is trauma-informed, and
yes,
undoubtedly we need services that take these things to account. Not that that's the only thing, and that, you know, I'm not saying bipolar is a result of trauma sometime in your life, and you know, and picking it, if you can unpick where the trauma came, then you'll sort out the bipolar. That's not the case. It's it's complex, it's multifactorial, but all of these things are important. But perhaps the key is treating people as an individual.
Absolutely. Not
just the labels are helpful. The label can help. They can help people get there. They can help put people in touch with other people with bipolar disorder. And I think probably that's one of the most helpful things, is that, yeah, because people can learn from each other. Put people in touch with organisations such as Bipolar UK, who do such a fantastic job. Yeah, but actually it doesn't, you know, but you need to go beyond that label and look, you know, yeah, at the individual. And certainly in clinicians as services, we need to do that better. I'm hopeful, you know, I'm positive about
going
in the right direction. I think we've a long way to go. Yeah. And I think a lot of people out there are going to have still very difficult experiences of getting help and getting treatment. You know, and we have to do better, but yeah, but I think we can and we will, you know, go in the right direction, I think.
And just in the last 10 years, it's worlds apart. It's like light and day in terms of, you know, my experience 10 years ago, just the fact that so many people are talking so openly about it now on so many open social platforms is just, you know, mind-blowing to me. One more question, last question before we go, if that's okay for you. With all of the people that you've spoken to with lived experience and determining kind of what led them to have their first experience that they were affected by bipolar disorder, what were the top kind of reasons that somebody would end up living with bipolar disorder? Is it hereditary? Is it genetic? Was it, you know, you say you made reference to birthing and pregnancy. What was it that you learned?
I've already said that one of the things that really got me interested in perinatal mental health and in pregnancy and childbirth was how common it was for having a baby to be a really trigger of a severe episode or a first episode. Yeah, I think bad things happening, you know, traumas can trigger off. Yeah, but I don't think that means that it's 100% due to the trauma, because different people are vulnerable, aren't they? You know, perhaps our genetic background that we inherit from our families, you know, means that some of us are more vulnerable to having episodes when things happening. With bipolar, it's interesting because good things happening can be a trigger as well. You know, I don't know if people listening have had that experience, but positive, you know, big changes, positive changes. Sleep disruption comes up again and again. So foreign travel, you know, working shifts. You know, having to study all night for finals or something, or for exams can be a trigger. So there's lots of different things. So it's having a relationship breakup, yeah, lots of things that can trigger this illness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's important to understand those, but it's important to understand that some people are more vulnerable to those triggers than other people, and that's where perhaps the genetic factors come in. So I'm a big believer that part of the explanation of what makes some people vulnerable to bipolar is genetic, but it's not the only explanation. It's a combination of that with all the other things that we know are important as well. So it's all about that balance, you know. Mm-hmm. And what I get really angry about is where I see people are very unbalanced and thinking, you know, that it's, you know, yeah, and try to tell everybody, you know, what it is that's causing their bipolar, you know, that actually, if they only ate more fish, that they'd sort it out.
If only it was that easy.
Because that's the other thing. It's difficult. It's complicated. It's multifactorial.
And I think
there's a lot we can do to understand this illness better, and there's a lot we can do with a collaboration of people with lived experience participating in research, helping us think about what the research questions are. Involving people with lived experience, clinicians, researchers. Given how many people experience this severe, if you compare the investment in research that's going into mental health in general and bipolar disorder in particular, actually, if you compare it to some of the other things, even in mental health, you know, yeah, it's an orphan condition. It's the Cinderella. Yeah. It's not getting the investment it needs. And I think if we did have that research, that's the best way of us getting to that level of understanding where we could make those big advances in understanding better how to help people. Yeah, clearly we need to improve the services, you know, based on what we know at the moment. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And I think, you know, but actually as a researcher, yeah, as a clinician, I think we need to do better, you know, in the clinical services and ways in which to help people. I think we've learned a lot about that, and the approaches that we're taking using self-management, psychoeducation, these things mm-hmm. are really important, that not just medication. Medication is important. Mm-hmm. But as a researcher, I think doing that research that can help us understand better, lead to those, you know, breakthroughs that we can really, lead to the next step in treatment will be, you know, really important in the years to come. So, and I think it's exciting. As I say, I don't want to give the impression that we're, you know, that there isn't huge issues for people living with this condition. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think, yeah, we were going hopefully in the right direction. And the more we understand, the more we find out about this illness, the more that we can together work out how to live best with it.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been a great conversation, and I'm looking forward to sharing it with everyone. So thank you so much.
Excellent. Thanks, Emma. Thanks. It's been an immense pleasure talking to you, and I'm really glad that I've had this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Let's Talk Bipolar, the podcast brought to you by Bipolar UK. Please go to our website, www.bipolaruk.org, for all of our resources and all of the support that we can offer you.